Are you saying we're unfocused?
It's possible.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Brian Reese.
Hi, I'm Brian Reese, and I am mourning the death of Wazi Supper Club.
Anyone outside of the Denver area probably does not know what that means. Wazi Supper Club was a, how would you describe it, Brian? A fine eatery?
It was a fine eatery and beverage establishment where? That you and I had spent many, many, many a night.
Yes, at most I think pretty much the late 90s.
Yes, during my days in Denver, Wazi Supper Club was a primary part of my life during those years, and it is going away, and I am sad, and you are in Denver, and I am in Chicago, and I am already missing the Wazi Supper Club.
Yes, it is a historic landmark, which is going the way of the dodo, I guess.
Goodbye, Wazi Supper Club.
Goodbye, Wazi Supper Club. Okay, well, we've been a bit off schedule due to the Thanksgiving holiday. Mostly that's my fault, so sorry about that.
Yes.
Shame.
Shame.
Shame. Ring your little bell, make me walk down the street.
Naked.
Naked throwing feces on me. That would be great.
Naked.
Now, today on the
podcast brought to you by naked.com. Don't look that up.
Now, today on the program, we will be talking about the wonderful run of Thor by Walter Simonson, specifically the first volume of his run, which comprises issues 337 to 335. But first, there's a couple of things that have come up since the last time we recorded, one of which is the firing of Axel Alonso as editor-in-chief at Marvel.
Now, was he fired?
Yeah, he was fired.
Yes, I know.
This comes hot on the heels
they're not exactly forthcoming about the details.
Well, look, this comes hot on the heels of the defection of Brian Michael Bendis.
Right.
And it seems like Marvel is cleaning house and trying to, not a bad idea at all. Specifically, I think it might have some Disney influence trying to get things straight.
Oh, sure. It's like DC getting restructured when Time Warner decided to take a stronger hand.
Exactly.
It's similar to that in terms of Marvel, ABC and Disney / ABC / Marvel, et cetera. They're just taking a stronger hand in terms of their property.
Yeah. Well, they're doing great on the movie side of things.
Sure.
So you'd think... You'd think they want to have the comic book side of things to going stronger as well. So Alonso's replacement is C.B. Cebulski. Now, you and I, Brian, have talked off mic about some, possible.
Well, I think there are some issues with C.B. Cebulski in terms of some cultural appropriation. It's not really something that we need to talk about here, partly because. We don't have some of the information we don't completely have. Some of the ramifications have not yet played through yet at the time that we are recording this. It isn't necessarily within the realm of what we are doing for this podcast. I have opinions on the matter. You have opinions on the matter. Mm-hmm. Our listeners probably are going to have some opinions on the matter. But... for our purposes right now, while we're still waiting for certain pieces to fall into place, I think that at this point, and correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, we want to just focus on the change at editor-in-chief as opposed to some of the more interesting or salient aspects that we could address at a later point.
Exactly. And what's germane to this conversation is the fact that, first of all, Cebulski has some ties to the Disney side of things, which lends credence to the parent company wanting to take a stronger hand. But more importantly, he has a reputation of finding new talent, which is something that Marvel is in desperate need of right now.
very desperate need of. I mean, Marvel has done a good job. Recently, they brought in Donny Cates, which I think a lot of folks are very excited about. I've read his first issue of Doctor Strange, and it's already an improvement, not over the Jason Aaron run, but over the fill-ins that have happened over the past 5 or 6 months. You can see Donny Cates on Doctor Strange, and we could talk about this at another podcast, but you can already see like a very strong vision of where he wants to go with Doctor Strange, which is in keeping with where Marvel wants to bring in some new, fresher voices.
Exactly. And they're probably going to lock down Jason Aaron so he can't go anywhere.
I hope they don't, because I'd like to see him elsewhere.
No, he's the last bastion of the old guard at Marvel. I think they're going to lock him in a basement somewhere just with a pen in his hand.
As long as his image work doesn't suffer.
Exactly. But anyway, this whole thing, I think, is a needed change at Marvel. Things needed to be shaken up, and I'm hoping that something new comes from it, something more innovative and creative, a new direction.
Yeah, and that never hurts, right? It doesn't hurt for any publishing company, any storytelling company, whether it be film, television, comics, magazines, literature, what have you. It never hurts to bring in a fresh editorial stance on things and shake things up a little bit. Whether it succeeds or not is beside the point. It's necessary.
Yes, and at least something needed to be tried.
Right.
Because obviously the direction they were headed was stagnant.
Right. And it's kind of difficult for me because people really hate on Axel Alonso. I mean, they're really hating on him. And I think that's legitimate in terms of how he was attempting to direct Marvel was not working. But people forget that he was an editor at Vertigo during some of its glory years and had done a great job as an editor at Vertigo, which is why he got scooped up by Marvel as an editor at Marvel and eventually becoming, you know, the EIC at Marvel. But part of me feels bad for the cat because I'm like, he does have good instincts, but his instincts did not serve him well within the Marvel universe. And I'll be curious to see where he goes from here.
Yes, I agree with that 100%. But it's not uncommon for someone to, you know, just not be the correct fit for a particular role.
It wasn't working.
Right. And it's perfectly acceptable to say, hey, it's not working. Let's try something new.
Right.
I don't think he's going to be out of work. He'll probably get another editing
job
somewhere.
Yeah, I don't think you'd go from editor-in-chief of one of the top two comic book companies in the United States and then be unemployed for long. Someone will scoop him up. But bringing in C.B. Cebulski, it's interesting. I mean, we've also heard that Joe Quesada is going to take a heavier hand again in editorial and in the comics themselves because he had moved away from that. Yeah. And there's indication, or he has said himself, he's going to be a stronger presence in the comic book end of things at Marvel. That's curious.
I don't think that's a bad idea. I mean, I know you're not a big fan of Quesada, but when he first came in as editor-in-chief at Marvel, there was a pretty outstanding time for creativity and that new direction.
Well, I think he made some good editorial choices in terms of where Marvel was. That was kind of he was the head during what one considered like sort of a golden age at Marvel.
Yeah, a little renaissance that they had.
Companies go through golden ages and not golden ages, and they go back and forth. But he was the editor in chief during a golden age at Marvel. I think that his public persona could have used some work, and I hope he has learned from that. But as far as guiding the company, there was some really great stuff that came out of Marvel during his reign.
Exactly. So hopefully this bodes well for Marvel in the future. You know, it remains to be seen what comes
out. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. It's comics are best when Marvel and DC both do well. And I don't mean that as a strike against the independents, because there are so many great comic book companies that are doing amazing work, maybe even better than Marvel and DC's stuff. But Marvel and DC hold the properties that are in the public consciousness. It's Spider-Man and Batman, it's Superman and Thor, it's Captain America and Wonder Woman, whoever you want, they hold the properties that are in the public consciousness. So as great as Image is, as great as Boom is, as great as Dynamite is, or whatever other companies are producing great comics, at the end of the day, it does become about the big two in terms of the properties that people know. And so when DC and Marvel do well, we win. When DC and Marvel do badly, we lose, unless it sends people to the smaller publishers and that helps them out. So I guess I contradicted myself a little bit, but that's part of the great thing about comics, the contradiction. I went out of continuity, Paul.
It was a crossover. It's fine.
I went out of corporate continuity.
It's fine. Well, you know, I don't hold to this DC versus Marvel garbage.
It's so silly.
It is. Look, as we've mentioned many times on the show, I have a preference to Marvel just because I have an affinity towards those particular characters. But I also love DC characters as well. And as a comic book fan, I want good stories all around. So I don't like it when one company is not doing well.
Right.
I mean, I didn't revel in the fact that New 52 wasn't good for the most part.
Right. I mean, there were some good things in New 52.
Yeah.
Not a lot, but there were some good things in New 52, and there are some good things currently in Marvel. Not a lot, but let's get an even playing field. And again, to reiterate, let's lift up some of these other comic book companies that are doing really great work, whether it be, independent artists or non-superhero type works going on in comics right now. There's so much great stuff. There are so many great things out there in the comics world that aren't superhero oriented that other comic book companies are doing. And it would be great to see these publishing companies raised up as well into the same sort of conversation that we have with Marvel and DC. I don't know if that will ever happen again because of existing properties, but Marvel and DC doing well ideally would help lift up other comic book companies. I don't know if that will ever happen.
Well,
it's a dream.
Like you said, ideally, rising tide lifts all boats and all that.
Right.
Yeah. So that's it for that. Hopefully Marvel gets better and we'll see some good stories coming from it.
And the jury's out on Cebulski. We'll see if he actually is able to take the reins of Marvel. By the time this posts in a week or so, there may be more information. And so some of this may be outdated, but I wish the best for him. And again, as a DC guy, primarily, like as you're primarily a Marvel guy, I really hope that Marvel gets its poop together and is able to kind of right the ship and give us good stories.
Yeah, absolutely. If Marvel can do the same thing that DC did with Rebirth, it'll be just fantastic. It won't help my bank account much, but I would love to have an overabundance of really great comics.
Yeah. Good comics, no matter who is making them, is a good thing.
Brian?
Paul?
Let's take a break, because I want to talk about Thor.
All right, and then we will Thor it up.
Star Trek. Comic books. Mythology. Video games, toys, Star Wars, just about any geeky topic you can think of could be covered on the Hammer Podcast, presented by two true freaks. Come join me, Gene Hendricks, for whatever my disjointed mental processes can come up with and be careful, or you might just learn something before we're done. The Hammer Podcast is available monthly, both on its own iTunes feed and at twotruefreaks.com.
And we're back. Thor by Walter Simonson, Volume 1, collects the issues number 337 through 345 of Thor. Originally published in 1983 onward, these issues were written and drawn by Walter Simonson. Rarely in comic book history does a creator leave their unique and influential mark on a character quite as profoundly as Walter Simonson did with Thor. You cannot speak about the character of Thor in Marvel Comics without also mentioning in the same breath of the name of Walt Simonson. He didn't create the character, but he took him to new heights that he had never reached before. He expanded the mythology of Thor by adding back traditional elements of Norse mythology, while at the same time adding new twists to that mythology as well. He expanded the roles and backstories of older side characters while also adding new characters, some of which would go on to become fan favorites. In this volume, we follow Thor as he meets a horse-faced alien named Bill, who turns out to be more than what he seems. We learn of the machinations of Loki and the deception of the seductress Lorelei. We see the fall of Baldur the Brave as he struggles to regain his confidence. And of course, we follow the adventures of Thor himself, as he loses his mortal alter ego and gains a not-so-subtle new one. He fights a demon, he becomes an ally of a frail warrior, and he fights off the nefarious plans of the Dark Elves, led by Malekith the Accursed. All the while, in the background, an unseen, malevolent evil is waiting, forging an army set on conquest, destruction, and doom.
Doom!
From the glittering halls of Asgard to the gritty streets of New York, Simonson expanded the scope and breadth of these stories, weaving epic tales of heroic adventure, heartfelt romance, comedy, and melodrama worthy of ancient Viking poetry. And it's a hell of a lot of fun to experience. So what do you think, Brian?
Oh, man. this is one of the great runs, right? I mean, this is just, what do I think? I mean, that we haven't covered this run sooner. And it's not just the run that we're talking about now, his entire run. I mean, we didn't even get to Frog Thor.
Oh, no. And then we get into the invasion of Asgard and all kinds of stuff.
Frog Thor isn't even a joke. It's serious. What a great recommendation. And I think this is going to be one of those conversations where we're just going to be glowingly ebullient over this run.
Absolutely.
That's what I think.
Yeah. And the key is that, you know, this is very much a 1980s comic, and with very heavily brings in
exposition.
The Silver Age. Yeah. But it still holds up. I mean, it works really well for this. You know, Thor is a wordy guy to begin with.
Right.
Because of its epic scale, you know, that wordiness fits.
And what Walt Simonson does with the sort of like the epic, you know, dialogue, there's humor there. He definitely inserts humor into how Thor speaks. But it's also done with like a sort of a nudge and a wink.
No, absolutely. And it's really great storytelling. It's really great storytelling. I mean, and this is, you know, this era, typically at this time, there were lots of recaps. I mean, trade paperbacks weren't really a thing yet.
Right.
And sometimes since these stories went on for months, even years, so the recaps were a necessary thing to do at the beginning of every comic, and they could become tedious from time to time. But Simonson was able to make them really entertaining and weave them into the story in a unique way that it said it felt natural and not forced, you know.
Well, it felt epic, you know, and I mean, the way he presented it is he presented it as an epic. And so the recaps were, you could hear like a storyteller, you know, a Norse storyteller, they told
recapping around the fire with a you know, goblet
exactly.
of mead.
They told their story for 3 hours the night before and everybody fell asleep, and they revisited the story the next night, again around the fire, eating, you know, huge chunks of cow or lamb or what have you. And And,
I believe it's Mutton.
Mutton. There we go, Mutton. And you know, the storyteller is just reminding in a very verbose manner of where they left off. And yeah. Simonson does such a great job with that. And I think it's important because his Thor story is it's a complete piece, and it is an epic. His work on Thor is an epic, and every issue flows into the next issue, and he sets the stage for things in this run of comics for things that come 2 years down the line.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then that's, yeah, he weaves the stories in and out of one another because he has several different plot lines going on at any given time.
There's at least, I think I counted 5 or 6 different plot lines just in these 9 issues alone that come to fruition later on.
Yeah.
And
well, that's the brilliant thing about this run. Yeah, that's the brilliant thing about these runs, because everything in the end becomes important. None of these storylines are a throwaway thing. Everything is important to the overall story. Yeah. It was just incredibly well done.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's the series is a saga. It's a saga in and of itself. And with these 9 issues, we get a taste. And it's a very delicious taste. It's our mutton, as you earlier. But it's not the full feast in Valhalla, because we get the full feast in Valhalla once Simonson has finished his run.
Yeah. And that's, you know, part of this is that, you know, Simonson knew his mythology. He was a fan of Norse mythology, and he was not afraid to just pepper stuff all throughout, you know. Kirby kind of did that to a certain extent.
Well, he owes a debt to Kirby. Visually, his art definitely owes a debt to Kirby. I mean, we all owe a debt to Kirby, but there is a callback to Kirby in all of Simonson's art. Now, Simonson's art is his own, and it's great, but yeah.
Well, I think just to touch on the Kirby thing, I think that comic creators and fans, for that matter, since the 1960s, basically fall into 2 camps. I mean, those that think that Jack Kirby's artwork is the end-all, be-all, greatest of, you know, greatest in the industry, and those who are just not impressed. Well, I mean, there's very little middle ground there.
I wouldn't say not impressed, because you have like your Bill Sienkiewicz's who redefined.
Okay. And
almost uniquely on his own. That's not to suggest that he wasn't impressed by Kirby.
Yeah. Personally, I think all comics. This is my personal feeling. All comics since the 1960s are either an homage to or a reaction against the work of Jack Kirby. But as far as Walter Simonson is concerned, Jack Kirby is a god. You know, like you said, it's very much his own, but the influence of Kirby is just overflows throughout his panels.
Well, we could quibble. Yeah, I mean, that's a conversation for another podcast. I may strongly disagree with you on that, because I could name a ton of great artists pre-Kirby that are also influential. But you know what? For our purposes here, we'll stick with that, because otherwise then we're adding another 2 hours to this podcast. So
so we're going to do our... okay. I'm right, by the way, just so you know. Anyway, you can see Simonson's obvious admiration of Kirby. And for the most part, I think his art is very traditional. Don't get me wrong, it's great. Mm-hmm. But his panel layout and structure are very straightforward. You know, in the 80s, you were seeing things that were different. They're different, unique panel layouts that were happening at this time.
Right. There was an attempt to move away from the traditional structure of panel layout.
So for the most part, I think that Simonson stayed very traditional, with one exception. The way he uses word balloons at the top and bottom of panels, and the way they straddle 2 panels together, it makes your eye has to scan up and down each panel. That way you don't miss any detail of the art or action. Simonson kind of subtly nudges you to see the things he wants you to see.
Yes. And that's a great point, Paul, because I was just reading a comic the other day. I'm not going to mention which one it was, but I realized that I was focusing on the top half of the panels. Like if there was a full page or like a half page panel, I wasn't looking at the feet, you know. I wasn't having a Rob Liefeld moment where I was concerned about what the feet looked like. I was looking, the artist had, everything was drawn to the upper half of the panel. And I realized as I was looking at it, and maybe it's because I had just reread Simonson's Thor, and this is exactly to your point, I was just looking at the top half of the panel where the artist had made the action happen in that part of the panel, and then the bottom half was throwaway, and it actually made me think of exactly what you're just saying is, with Simonson, you had to see the whole panel mattered. Even if it was just a small square in like a 9-panel page, you had to look at the full panel.
Yeah, he pushes your eye. He forces you to see. It's an interesting way to use the medium to its full potential, because it is words and pictures. And the way he laid it out, he forced you to see everything as you read it. So you didn't miss any details. And that's just another aspect of great storytelling.
And I'm not sure if this is where we want to talk about the sound effects. Do we want to talk about the sound effects now?
As absolutely.
Part of the layout, or do we want to move that, or do we want to talk about that later?
No, we could do sound effects right now.
Because we have to talk about the sound effects.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, the obvious one that I said in the synopsis was, or the introduction, was Doom.
Doom. And Doom plays out through all that, and that's an important actual plot point that we can hit later. But, I mean, so I wrote down just a few of these. Twack. Yow. Crunch. Funk-la-chunk. Roar. Bada-boom. Katha Kataboom. What else do I have? A Baratha Whom. Crackalacta. Schlatter. Famoosh. I'm not even like.
Yeah.
This is just like scratching the surface of the great sound effects. And I think that Marvel has taken that concept and moved it even forward. You know, there's a lot of playful sound effects that come into play down the line. But I think Simonson perfected that, because these sound effects are amazing.
Yeah, I agree. And they're perfectly utilized.
Yes.
You know,
they're part of the art.
Yes.
The sound effect, and it's part of, like, besides the fact that, you know, they're onomatopoeia, they work within the art.
Yeah.
Which is astonishing. I mean, what a great technique.
Oh, absolutely. And it works to set a mood too. You're completely immersed in this story, both visually and audit. You know, he's adding an auditory aspect to this to this medium. It's really, I could just gush for a while.
Right. You know? I mean, I think it's important that, like, if someone listening to this has not read any of these panels, just look up a Walt Simonson panel with these sound effects worked into the art, and you can see the brilliance of how that is done. And I don't think anybody has properly matched that.
And even, and aside from the sound effects, there's little details he does within the art. Specifically, I'm thinking of the first covers with Beta Ray Bill. There's one cover where Beta Ray Bill is, you know, hammering down with Mjolnir, and it knocks. What is that image called? You know, the little corner image with the character. Does that have a specific name? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Probably. We want to edit this part because neither of us know.
It doesn't matter. but anyway, there's a little character corner, and Beta Ray Bill knocks Thor off panel. And then the very next issue, Beta Ray Bill is that character. And he remains that character until that storyline is resolved. And then Thor slowly, slowly starts to come back on that. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. His attention to detail was astounding, to the point where even just little details that would normally be a throwaway, he's taking time and care to add something visually interesting to it.
Yeah. And let's not forget the fact that he was writing and drawing.
Oh, yeah.
And doing the color. And doing his own inking, and he was doing this on a monthly basis.
All right. I don't think he was doing the color.
Was he not?
I could be wrong about that. I know he wasn't doing the lettering.
He wasn't, because it was John. Was it John Workman that was doing the lettering?
Oh, I don't have it in front of me right now. But I really should. Okay. So should we get into some of the specific plot details?
Well, so we've gushed about the art.
Right.
So let's talk about the plotting and the story itself.
Yes. Well, it's set up as very, very much a soap opera, which is not uncommon for the time.
Well, it's very typical of Marvel at the time.
Yes. But it interweaved so many, like we talked about, so many different storylines with an over, and you know, I was trying to think of it as the way TV shows are done now, where each one has an episode, but there's an overarching theme or villain.
Right. That carries through. Right. That
carries through. Well, that's what he did with this, because he introduces a villain, which will not come to fruition for another, like, at least two volumes.
Yeah. Sutor doesn't come into play as a true villain for a while yet, but he is one of the true big bads of all comics history.
Right. Yeah. And just the interweaving, laying little seeds that will not come to fruition for issues down the line.
Three or four panels that show him forging what we don't know that ends with doom. Every time it ends with doom. And that is carried through the 9 issues that we're reading. That's all we get.
Right.
But it is so foreboding.
Oh, I know.
I feel like we could talk about this for 2 or 3 hours, you know?
Oh, easily. This could be a podcast all its own. It could just be a read-through of this comic. But let's talk about some particular details, and one is the horse-faced alien in the room, Beta Ray Bill.
Which is a favorite character of yours, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, he's a great design, and he's very, very unique. You know, no one up until this point in Thor comics was able to lift the hammer. So the idea of anyone else being worthy was unheard of at the time. So it's a great idea, because the notion of someone who looks like the villain actually becoming the hero, or just as good as the hero, was a really novel idea.
Yes.
Continue. Sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
No,
this is your baby, man.
Well, no, I really loved that whole storyline, because, you know, Simonson initially sets him up as, you know, he's a demon. He's going to be the big adversary of Thor. And that moment when he picks up the hammer, it's shocking. I remember the first time reading that and going, oh my God.
Yeah. We don't realize now how unique and shocking that was, because now everybody in the Marvel Universe has picked up Thor's hammer at some point over the past 3 years.
Yeah, for some reason or another.
All right, I'm exaggerating, but you get, you know, and it's, yeah, yeah, we hadn't seen that, or at least as kids reading this, which we were both kids-ish, early teens, kids, you know, we hadn't seen this before, and it is a remarkable moment in comics history that someone else could pick up Thor's hammer. It seems like a small thing now, but at the time it was revelatory.
Yeah, but not only is it someone picking up the thing, because you can see, you know, Captain America is worthy enough to pick up the hammer because he's.
But that connection had not been made at the time.
Right, but what makes this so unique is the way Beta Ray Bill looks, because, you know, we're used to seeing the ugly guy is the bad guy.
Right.
And this one, the ugly guy is actually more worthy than the hero.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a fascinating fascinating line of storytelling there.
And a character that is also very strongly conflicted in terms of his place, not just, you know, in the universe, but specifically to his own people. And then when faced with the Norse gods, the fact that with all of the conflicted nature within Beta Ray Bill, that he was still strong enough and worthy enough to pick up the hammer says a lot about what the hammer means.
Exactly. I mean, even Odin is like, oh, didn't expect that to happen.
Yeah. Well, and I think, and also just the introduction of Beta Ray Bill, which adds to what Walt Simonson did, and correct me if you feel differently about this, the cast of characters within Thor, I don't feel has ever been as well utilized as Walt Simonson did.
Oh, no, absolutely. Especially the Warriors 3, which are usually just, you know, comic relief or something like
comic
that.
Comic relief, Volstagg is always comic relief. Although, yeah. I think Volstagg is one of the most badass characters in all of comics. And you never really fully realize it because he is played off as a joke. But every time you see Volstagg have to step up, he beats the shit out of anyone who comes his way.
Yeah. Well, the way that Simonson uses Volstagg, he uses him as comic relief, but he's always doing something very competent. You know, he's playing the fool, but he's
Very aware
of it.
he's used as the teacher. He is used as the holder of the mythos when he in the 9 issues we're talking about, where he has to school the young upstart in the history of Baldur the Brave.
Yes, and there's a part where he sits on him. And it's,
he sits on him through most of. He's sitting on this guy through most of the 9 issues, which is awesome.
Yes, and he just. Yes, it is awesome, but it's all done as, oh, I didn't know I was sitting on you. He knew full well he was sitting on him.
Right.
And it's comic relief, he's very aware of what he's doing.
And this comic gives full, characterization to Sif, to Loki, to Carnilla, to Baldur, to Lorelei, to Odin, even Freya gets like some strong characterization. She gets some stronger characterization later, but even in this, we have Freya getting some. Heimdall gets strong characterization. Fafnir, no less, as the great dragon nemesis, gets some strong characterization. And it seems like Simonson has drawn all of these characters in and he gave them all some very strong. Characterization.
He gave them all motivation, and he gave them a reason to be there. In previous Thor comics, these characters were there, but they were sort of window dressing because it was always Thor's. It was Thor's baby, and everybody else was just there to tell him how great he is.
And we haven't even hit the great work he does with the Gladiator.
Yes.
Down the line. I mean, and this is us encouraging you to read this and then keep going, because what he does with the Gladiator is maybe one of the most important moments in comic history.
Yep, I agree. There are little things that he did that Simonson did too that changed up the mythology of Thor in general, just the comic book mythology. For instance, he got rid of his alter ego. As I mentioned, there's no more Dr. Donald Blake.
It's Sigurd Jarlson.
Yes. And that led to one of the, famous comic book panels where he puts on his glasses to become the alter ego, and he bumps into
Clark Kent. I love that sequence. It's like 5 or 6 panels, and then even Lois Lane is there.
Yes, but it just shows that people won't recognize you if you just put glasses on.
And it's a running joke, because it's a running joke. Like when he's Sigurd Jarlson and he's working on the building site, and everybody's like, "That guy looks like It's one of those, yes, and you're right, it's one of those great inside jokes in comics that I think
absolutely lasts. And it's so funny, because in one panel, Thor is carrying like all these beams, like steel beams, and people are like, that Sigurd guy is pretty strong. It's obvious he's Thor.
at one point, isn't the foreman, Jerry, thinks... finally figures it out, and he's like, oh, this guy's Spider-Man.
Yes. Oh, it's great. Yeah, and then, so there's that. I love the Beta Ray Bill storyline. It ends in this volume, but it gets picked up again later in Simonson's run. But just to finish him off, the tragic nature of him is, because he has himself altered to look different, to be the protector of his people. Right. And because of that, his people don't, are afraid of him.
Right.
So he's the protector of his people, but he can't be a part of them anymore. That's a really, tragic, melancholy aspect of the character that you don't normally get something like that.
It's something that plays out over time, and it also it's part of like the larger narrative in comics is what makes a hero, and that is one of the sort of. That's one of the ground zero moments of all comics is what makes a hero, and the assumptions that are put on Peter Parker is a skinny, scrawny kid who puts on a costume, to become a greater thing. Or Captain America, Steve Rogers is a skinny, scrawny kid. Bruce Wayne is a Lothario, playboy, you know,
well, that's
responsible, you know, but then he puts on a costume. Clark Kent puts on, you know, Superman puts on a pair of glasses and he's Clark Kent, who is like clumsy and can't walk down the street without tripping over his own shoelaces, but he puts on a costume and then becomes a hero. Beta Ray Bill is this ugly outcast who, when he strikes the hammer, becomes a thing more than what the perception of him is.
Yeah, well, it's almost as if his sacrifice is the thing that made him honorable, if that's
what, right,
you know, made him worthy. So, yeah, so that storyline is fantastic, but it continues on with with Thor fighting Fafnir, a giant dragon. In his
if Sigurd only was Jarlson. Bang boom, but sorry, go on.
Well, no, that's all very funny too, where he has to fight him in his alter ego guise,
right?
And doesn't anyone notice that he's carrying a giant hammer in his backpack at all times?
No, of course not, because they don't notice that he's twice the size of anybody that he's working with.
Well, he has glasses on.
Yes. And the beautiful blonde locks that he's got tied back in. I love the fact that Sigurd Jarlson is a ridiculous character, and I think that was intentional. So
and purposely.
I'm not pointing that out as a criticism, because I think that Simonson had a hell of a lot of fun with the Sigurd Jarlson alter ego.
Yeah, well, he was trying to satirize the whole alter ego thing,
right?
In comics, anyway. But I guess, should we talk about Malekith?
We can. Malekith. I mean, I think Malekith is difficult because, well, what would you like to talk about with Malekith?
Well, I like the way that Simonson really heavily used the fairy mythology with him. Because right. In the past, he'd always been, he's a dark elf. What does that mean? Don't think about it. He's got a cool design. But he really, really worked in the fairy mythology.
Go ahead.
No, continue.
I think the elvish, working in the elvish mythology is a little tricky on this. It's the one sort of part of this that I draw back on just a tad, because elvish mythology is not strong in Norse mythology.
Well, no, I think he was, you know, Simonson was definitely mixing and matching to suit his purposes.
Right.
And, you know, if you've got Norse gods, why not have, I mean, because there's also Greek gods in Marvel continuity, why not have fairies as well?
But it's so strong in the Norse mythology that introducing an elf was a little weird. This is not a criticism. I should not present this as a criticism, but it is a weird moment where I have like a little bit of cognizant disconnect.
Really? I enjoyed that. I like the way that they use the fairy, you know, eating the fairy food makes you a servant of fairy. Yeah. And
which is true, as we all know.
And always keep a handy French fry in your pocket, just in case.
Yeah, I think that was the other part, is it was really weird that the collection ended with that last chapter, which really belonged... The last chapter with the French fry and the it's a really odd issue to include in the collection, and this was a collection,
right.
So there was a conscious decision to include that last issue in this collection, where, man, I really feel like it's a good issue, but it really belongs in the second collection.
Well,
is that too much of a quibble?
I think for this it is, because I really think that the Marvel publishers knew that you're going to read this whole thing.
Right.
You're not just going to buy volume one and that's it.
Right.
You're going to get Walter Simonson's Thor from
start to finish. Or you're going to do the Visionaries, or you're going to do the Omnibus, or you're going to do...
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I'd actually like to get my hands on the Omnibus of this. It looks really nice. But overall, I just... You know, we could go on and on and on about this in every minute detail. But overall, this is one of the just classic great runs of comics in general. It is must read. If you're a comic book fan, this is a must read. Not just this first volume, but the entire Simonson run of Thor. It's a glorious thing to behold.
I mean, it's steeped in mythology. It's steeped in comics. It's steeped in great art. There is so much about this, and the way that he forms the story from an internal out to the external, and all of the pieces he puts into play that seem disparate at the time. And even in this 9-issue series, you see those disparate pieces starting to come into play, but this is only a taste of how good it is. And you see it like as it spreads out, and he created his own, I think Simonson with Thor, with his Thor run, created his own unique mythology in the same way that I think that, forgive me for the overreach, but in the same way that Milton Milton created his own creation mythos, Simonson created his own Thor mythos that I think people, when they think of Thor now, they think of Simonson's run, even if they have no knowledge of comics or no knowledge of Walt Simonson or what have you.
Yeah, that's quite possible.
When Thor is represented in contemporary culture, it comes from Walt Simonson's run. I understand that I'm reaching a bit there. I'm not trying to compare Simonson to Milton, but
damn it, I think we should.
In terms of
Shakespeare, impact, Milton, Simonson. That's the way.
Shakespeare, Milton. Dante, Milton,
there you Shakespeare, go.
Simonson. There
you go. Okay. I thought you were going to go with Gaiman and hit the way he created the mythology with Sandman.
Well, Gaiman is his own. That's three or four podcasts that we got in the pipeline. Gaiman right. is a whole other realm of podcasts.
Absolutely. So
did I misrepresent that, Paul? Do you want to add your own?
No. You're absolutely correct. But I think we need to start wrapping this up. So that was Thor by Walter Simonson. Just an absolutely fantastic run of comics. I highly suggest you go out and get that if you haven't already read it. But for next time, Brian, do you have a recommendation for what we should be reading and then talking about on the next episode?
I do. I do indeed. So for the next podcast, I am recommending Phonogram, Volume 1, Rue Britannia, by Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey. It's a little bit of a departure from us, but I think it's necessary.
I'm very excited for that. It's a fabulous and unique type of comic, and we need to spread out. We've been a little DC Marvel heavy on this show, and I think we need to spread out, and that's a perfect way to do it. All right, so that sounds that's fantastic. I don't think we even scratched the surface with Thor. So that's this episode of the Collected Edition. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and until next time, keep reading comics.
Be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at the Daddy Elk Productions handle @DaddyElk and use the hashtag Collected Edition. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
I actually liked the look of Thanos. Now, if you watch his progression throughout the movies and all the little post-credit stuff, he used to be wearing this big old armor.
Right.
And every movie, that armor has been getting smaller and smaller until now he's just a guy because he doesn't need it anymore. He's
got the Infinity. He kind of looked like a purple dude with like some bad, who maybe got like, you know, something wrong with his chin.
He's got Skrull chin.
Yeah, he's got Skrull chin. Hashtag Skrull chin.
Yeah, you need a little lotion. I got some Skrull chin.
Hashtag Skrull chin.
when Black Panther gives that speech and he finally says, and get that man a shield. It's like, that's, I mean, man, I'm 8 years old again.
All right.
This is so cool.